You're listening to the Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our second parter of our fall 2018 anime season reviews. We're from the otakuspirit.com website. You can go for our anime new and old, great community, the form links at the top, social media links on the right side, and all the good stuff. Yes, today we are reviewing another slew of shows for the fall season. We have on this docket Merc Storia, Zombieland Saga, Golden Kamuy 2, Space Battleship Terumisu 2, Goblin Slayer, Fist of the North Sky 2, and Thunderbolt Fantasy 2. So lots of twos. What was it like last season? We had like a bunch of threes because it was Overlord and My Hero Academia and stuff.
Seems like it.
This is a season of twos, apparently. So yeah, we're going to go through all these, tell you what they're about, give you our impressions on them, and then you can decide if it was worth it to watch or not. And we'll let you guys know if it was worth it to watch or not because we're done with them. So some of them happy to be done with. Some are really sad to be done with. And we'll get to them, though. But let's start off with Merc Storia, the apathetic boy and the girl in the bottle. That's the full title. It's a weird one. Or Merc Storia, Mukiryuko Shonen to Bin no Naka no Shoujo. This one is streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, been done by Studio Encourage Films. The source is a game, and the genres are action, adventure, fantasy, and magic. And this one follows a boy named Yu. He's in a world where it's kind of, like not so distant future, or not so distant past, I'm sorry. What would put the time frame? Something like, Spice and Wolf time frame, yeah. Something like that. Pre-industrial, stuff like that. Anyways, they're in this one village, and he's from a family of people that know how to do this sort of healing to monsters throughout the world. Monsters throughout the world are aggressive, and these certain people with certain abilities can actually heal them and make them, regain their minds and be kind and gentle and normal. I would just say normal. Yu's father is one of these particular healers, and now Yu is an apprentice to become one of these healers as well. The thing that they kind of hit on the first episode, which they never hit on ever again, is the fact that he's like deathly afraid of monsters. And that's kind of a joke in the first episode that he's like terrified of them and doesn't want to go out and be a healer because he's scared of them. And
I think they mentioned again in the Dreamland area.
Yeah, I don't remember it. Anyways, his father, after going on adventures, comes back with a jar, and in this jar, there's this little girl in it named Merc, and Merc is kind of a aquatic fairy or something like that, but she has no memories of her past self, and so it's kind of the whole joint of the venture idea that Yu is going to go out and adventure and help Merc find out why she's lost her memories and regain them. So they set out on an adventure together and go to different lands and try to find answers, even though it just kind of turns into a whole thing where they go to each of these lands and kind of find some problem there and is asked to resolve the issue and save the day, so to speak. So Merc Storia, people heard us talk about a lot in our deliberations.
Is this show and why are they talking about it?
We're the only ones that watched it. that was the running joke in the entire deliberations was, what the hell is Merc Storia? Now, Merc Storia is kind of one of those ones that just catches you off guard. I mean, I think I mentioned at some point, I think in our first impressions or something like that, that it's like, it's not a show that is trying to be adult. It's not trying to be mature. It's not trying to blow minds. It's just, it was a cute little adventure. These two characters who are going to these different locations. The first location, they go to they get shrunk and they go into a fairy world. And the fairy world, since they're shrunk, they're the same size as the fairies. And the fairies have an issue that's going on. And the next one, they kind of follow this girl, and she's kind of gets lost in this kind of dream world, and her father's trying to figure out where she's at, and it kind of hits on a little thing of, father's dreams, daughter's dreams kind of thing. And they have this whole song, like an area that's full of birds, bird people, and it's like entirely song-themed because the birds sing and whatnot. And then they had an angel episode where there's like these angel lands they go to. Each one of them are kind of self-encompassing, and they're just these cute little stories that have a lot of charm to them and a lot of heart to them, that it was very surprising me how much I enjoyed it. I think the big draw to it is definitely the characters are cute. The characters they run into are like those characters that you're like, I wish this character would stay with them throughout the entire story. I mean, I fell in love with the tomboy fairy in the first the first arc, it was she was so cute. She was trying to hide that she screwed up, but she knew that she needed to fix the issue. So each of these characters, they run into it. I want them to continue on the journey with them. Like, I want them to kind of just, they join the party and then they go to the next place and they comments in the next world. But it was just kind of, they were self-encompassed and they were just cool little stories. And it was also the one girl that was kind of, she had be arranged to marriage and all that kind of stuff was cute as well. So they're cute little stories that I really enjoyed. And like I said, they just had a lot of charm to them, a lot of heart to them. I thought that the bird arc itself was probably just stand out as being really well produced. It was the songs they were playing throughout it were really well done. The music, everything just hit at the right points. It was very emotional a lot of the times. I remember when they first had the girl go back on the stage and then it got kind of sabotaged, it was like very impactful and it had a lot of power to the scene. And it was kind of shocking. It's like, I didn't really, this is a show that nobody's talking about. And yet it's doing these things that are really cool and they're very impactful. And the quality of the visuals and everything were right on there along with it. So it's just one of those ones where I don't know that anybody's ever going to talk about it. I don't think it has anything that's really adult and deep and mature. It's just charming and really well put together.
It is one of those that I can see a lot of people just completely flipping it off because it's effectively a Pokemon spinoff, or not a Pokemon spinoff, a Pokemon clone. And I can see a lot of people just completely dismissing it because, oh, it's a cheesy Pokemon clone with a cute girl that follows the guy around. Done it, seen it. And it really kind of discounts this show because, like Andrew said, like, I really, really loved the Dreamland. I thought it was really cool. I agree with Andrew. The Tsundere fairy girl was just absolutely too adorable, and had a really, really cool story of redemption, holding yourself accountable. There was warring clans per se that are feuding clans, and get over your problem to get to the bigger issue and solve that. There was the songbirds, like Andrew said, the entire songbird land was really, really phenomenal. I really, really enjoyed the kind of undertones of what's socially acceptable versus your heart, which was a really cool little story. The Angel Land was really cool. It had the kind of elites versus
everybody else.
Yeah, everybody else. It was a really cool story.
It kind of looked down upon everybody else.
So it's one of those shows that I think it's really kind of, you're missing out on a really small little gem here. If not like it's the gem of the season, just it was a gem that I think that a lot of people kind of glossed over because of what it is.
Yeah, that's the troubling thing. It's like, it's hard to go out there and start banging the drum for it on Twitter and stuff like that, because it does technically have a very childish look to it, a very childish style to it. It is one of those shows where a kid can watch it with their parent, or the parents can watch it with their kids and be perfectly fine. There's nothing at all in there that is lewd. There's nothing in there that is, inherently violent. It's just a very charming show that has actual substance to it that adults can actually enjoy. It is kind of, I hate to make the comparison to something like a Disney movie these days, because the Disney movies have like undertones and they have these hidden sexual jokes and stuff like that for the adults to enjoy. This isn't really like that. It's just the charm and the characters and the world building and the storytelling that's doing, the production values a lot of the time is what is really the thing that kind of hooks you in there to keep watching. I won't say that all of them were knockouts. Like, I hate to go against what Chris was saying with the Dreamland, but for me personally, the Dreamland was probably the one that I really loved the ending to it. It was very cute. I love how the father was tied in with the daughter, that stuff. But the earlier parts of it, I was kind of like, eh, okay, I get it, pumpkin guy. I get it, pumpkin guy. Move on, kind of thing. But the rest of it, I really enjoyed. So it's there's very little to not enjoy. Yeah, and I would probably say even though the first episode had a lot of fun in it, like it was, it had a lot of fun with the action in it, chasing down Toto, the little rabbit thing, Majiggy. That was fun, just that whole thing. But it wasn't really a good first impression for the show because for me, it was kind of going back at it going, okay, it's got a charming look to it. I want to get a couple episodes. And we hit the fairy episode, and I was like, I really like this fairy princess girl. She's just absolutely fun. I want to stick with this. And it didn't let me down throughout the rest of it. So
And that was the thing. I mean, literally going off that first episode, like Andrew said, you're not going to get a good impression. Going into the
fairy... I totally thought you was going to be so obnoxious because he was so loud about his fear of the monsters.
Going into the second episode, you get introduced to the fairy princess, and you're like, she's adorable. I could really watch the rest of the show with the fairy princess. But you're like, well, more than likely, you're not going to get the fairy princess for the entire show. But
Pokemon on you where they fix the problem. He makes a new purse of his harem and they leave him behind.
Exactly. And so you've got these two hands. Which one is this show going to be? Is this going to be the show that's going to be awesome with the fairy princess? Or is this going to be a crap show that is just a Pokemon ripoff? More than likely, it's going to be a Pokemon ripoff. And I don't blame most people for thinking that. But it really does have its own charm, like Andrew was saying.
Well, that's a funny thing, because I would assume that the game is probably going to be based off of a mobile game or something like that, like a gacha game or a monster-building game. But it literally never, ever plays off of that. There's no... I mean, yeah, each... Technically, in each episode or each storyline... Yeah, it's an iOS game. Each storyline, he does end up running into some kind of beast that he needs to do his healing spell on. It does a little, Sailor Moon-ish looking little animation and the monsters in front of him. Actually looks kind of cool. That's basically it. Like, he does that, like, maybe once per storyline, and then that's it. There's no focus on, well, now he captured this monster. No, the monster walks away, heals them, and they go away. There's no, like, I capture that one, yeah, now I gotta train him up. No, the only one that follows him is Toto from the first episode, and it's really just a mascot character. So it is kind of interesting, the idea of, I wonder exactly how much the game relies on him gathering these monsters, or if it's just a case of he just goes around and heals them, and maybe other characters, maybe like the fairy queen is a character that would actually join his party. I don't know. But I'm making that point in the idea that it is based off of a game, but it really doesn't hint at all at a gacha or anything like that. It's literally just you and Merc going to each of these places and having the story kind of being told around them. Like I said, there are self-encompassed stories, so if anything, if you could only give one arc a watch, just go watch the Songbirds. I think the Songbirds were just... That story was excellent. And like I said, the production values were very surprising to me, and it had a cool little story in there that I thought was... But like I said, they all had cool stories. And like Chris mentioned, the fairy princess and her kind of, accepting responsibilities for her own actions and trying to push herself to, you know, leave her safety zone and go do what's right, and proving to her family that she's worth pennies, you know, worth something. Those kind of things were really cool. They were all really fantastic stories.
Worth pennies? I think she was worth $100.
I corrected myself. I would say more than $100. Very cool. Would this technically be the hidden gem of the season?
And that's what we're fighting. Thing.
Zombieland was just it. Can you still call Zombieland Saga a hidden gem? Because, like I said, I was still hyped for it because it was original MAPPA. So I can't say that was my hidden gem. This is the only one that caught me off guard. Like,
I think
really
this is the. I think Zombieland Saga. What would you call that? What's the term for something that everybody noticed right away, but it was kind of expected? And this one was the one that nobody's watching in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. Nobody's talking about it.
Like, even with, like, when... what would be another hidden gem? Like, Onihei.
Yeah.
That was totally a hidden gem. Nobody's talking about it. Nobody was talking about it. I like the hidden gems that nobody talked about. Those are the ones that really hit it for me. Yeah, looking at the list of all the shows this season, everything was kind of... Like, yeah, I would say Rascal Does Not Dream Bunny Girl Senpai was a hidden gem, but again, because people were talking about it so much, it didn't become that thing that I can tell people to go watch Rascal, but it's like everybody's like, yeah, I watched that. What else? This is the one that technically nobody else was watching. So
Gridman is a hit and miss. Some people love it, and some people are just trashing on it.
Yeah, that one got a lot of.
The ones who were trashing on it never got past episode 3.
SSS Gridman cannot be considered for Hidden Gem because it's both Gridman and it's Trigger. So there's no way to say that there was nothing that nobody seen that coming. So,
well, and like I said, the ones who the people who are bashing on it are the ones who only watched the third episode and then dropped it.
Yeah.
Everybody else who's talking praise of it has watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
There's nobody who's watched the whole thing and said, well, that's crap.
But I'm glad we got a lot of talking out of this one, because like I said, it's one of those ones where like it's very hard to just jump out there and start beating the drum on it, because it does have a certain aesthetic to it that I think a lot of people are just kind of like, that's a kid's show. Why would you want me to watch that? But I think it's worth it. I think, like I said, if you can only give it a couple episodes, watch at least the Songbird story and see what kind of charming and storytelling it has in there. And like I said, with that particular one, just this great music and great production values that they put into it. It's not a high budget show, but they pulled off some really great stuff for that.
I think that if you actually get through the fairy arc, you'll realize what this show really is. I mean, if you just stop within the second episode, you're not giving the show a shot at all.
Yeah, the only reason I hesitate on the fairy arc is just because of the fact that it's so. It does have some cliches in there. It does have archetypes that people would probably go, what are you telling me to watch here? But I still think, for me personally, it was a very charming story, and I absolutely fell in love with the princess. She was absolutely adorable. I just think the Songbird is just one of those ones where it kind of transcends all the things that people would go, oh, why are you telling me to watch this show? It kind of has values to it that I think kind of transcends archetypes and stuff. That's the only reason I'm aiming at one specific. I think they're all excellent stories, though.
And throwing it out there, you don't have to, just to help out Andrew, you don't have to watch Fairy Dreamland. They're stories, so the arcs are not relying on any other one. Well, you may need to know the first episode to know what's going on.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we said in the synopsis. They're traveling out there to find Merc's memories, so, or what's going on with their memories. So it did kind of have this, and it's no way, shape, or form anything like the other show, but I totally got like Midori no Hibi vibes from it. I'm like, no, I really want to watch Midori no Hibi. That show was so cute, but very lewd. Oh, man, that episode where he went to see her house. Man. Anyways, that's Merkstoria, the apathetic boy and the girl in the bottle, or Merkstoria, Muki Yoku Shonen to Bin no Naka no Shoujo. I don't know why I'm struggling so much with that one. Great little show. Definitely a hidden gem for me. Something that I really enjoyed watching, and I'm happy I stuck with it. So, yeah. Moving on, let's go into another big hitter for the season and year. Zombieland Saga. This one was streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio MAPPA. The source is an original. The genres, I have them backwards. The genres are comedy, music, supernatural. And this one follows a girl named Sakura, and she's getting ready to go to school. She's really excited. She's listening to her favorite idol show on, or idol group on the television. Getting all excited, she leaves to go to school, and she walks out into her front yard and says goodbye to her family, and then gets hit by a truck. Old truck-kun shows up again. Damn that guy. Anyway, she wakes up, and she's in a random mansion, dark mansion, and in that mansion, there's a bunch of what look like zombies, and they're coming after her, and she freaks out and runs out into the street, and then runs into a policeman, and the policeman terrifyingly shoots her in the head because she's a zombie. And she returns back to the mansion, or she's taken back to the mansion, and come to find out she is one of, seven girls that are zombies that this certain particular guy, Kotaro, has created to form a group, an idol group, that will perform in order to save Saga. And that's the premise, is this crazy, I would call him mad scientist because he definitely has a certain voice of Rintaro from Steins Gate, same seiyuu.
Rintaro.
And yeah, he's just kind of very, very absolute. Everything he says is kind of, it's he's crazily absolute about everything he says. They're going to go do this,
Fuck, wake up, zombie.
Go, go, go. And drag them to different locations, to different jobs in order to, you know, drum up their fame and eventually play at different concerts and stuff like that. So interesting. When this show first started, I think the initial thought that everybody had was that it was going to be a show that was going to critique or play off of tropes within the idol sphere specifically, just seeing idols and idol groups. But what it ended up kind of turning into is kind of every single arc, they're kind of focusing on different styles of entertainment. So they do rap, they do, the first one they do is headbanging and death metal. They do typical idol performances, they do concerts, they do game shows, and all kind of mixed in there is just this kind of really goofy playoff of the fact that they're zombies and they're trying to hide their identity that they are zombies while at the same time trying to perform. And it I think most of the jokes are kind of centered around Kotaro and his kind of absurd treatment of the girls, and at the same time the girls trying to hide the fact they're zombies. A lot of it around them trying to keep Tai from eating somebody because, like, right off the bat, they all kind of gain awareness, but except for Tai. Tai is, like, the only one that, for some reason, doesn't have awareness. The other kind of thing, the other kind of undertone that they have throughout the entire storyline and throughout the girls themselves is that it kind of focuses on the fact that they're all kind of idols from their own generation. So you have Yugiri, who's, like, way back there in, like, the Showa period, and they have some girls that are kind of in the, I don't know, like the 60s or whatever, whereas Sakura is kind of more recent. So, and Ai is kind of recent to her as well. So each of them, these girls have, they have a couple episodes where they kind of hit on the fact that some of the girls don't like how the newer generation of idols treat their fans. They kind of treat them as commodities, so to speak. And that kind of element was kind of interesting. I thought they were kind of going to hit that on some more, but they didn't really. They hit on it for a little bit, which I thought was, I kind of appreciated a little bit, but not probably as much as I wanted to. But it was kind of an interesting little element they kind of threw in there. I did enjoy all the stories. They're really great. They kind of hit a little bit of backstory on a few of the characters. Sadly, there's Yugiri and Tai really didn't get any kind of backstory to them, but I would assume that they hopefully will do more of this series. But they did kind of get their time to shine, which was nice as well. But yeah, the show overall, I really enjoyed it. It was easily a show of the year for me. I think it is kind of, like I mentioned earlier, twofold for me. Probably a good 70% of that enjoyment was probably around Kotaro. I think he was just, the seiyuu just nailed it. He was absolutely hilarious every time he was on the screen, just yelling at the girls. I remember one of the girls kind of busted through his little barrier, or he busted through a barrier to get to her because she was kind of closing herself in. He's like, "Zombies go on the other side of the barrier, idiot." That kind of stuff was just absolutely hilarious. How he's kind of drumming up the go, 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 running into him with trucks and then telling him to get up and move. He's just kind of absurdly entertaining. And yeah, a lot of it's kind of abusive, but at the same time, you kind of laugh at it because they are zombies, so they kind of just bounce right back, and then none of it really hurts them. It was just a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I think a lot of the humor is also in the girls and them trying to hide their identity. Sakura and kind of playing almost the straight man and kind of acknowledging the absurdity of it, kind of like we are. And all the stories were kind of cute and charming as well, so.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, especially right after watching Steins Gate Zero, and we didn't get the Hoenn treatment per se, except for towards the very, very end of that show. And that's kind of what makes Rintaro just really something special. And having him in this one, and that's actually exactly who he's playing, is that mad scientist Hoenn. Just too much to a T, and he just has so much fun playing that character. And then on top of that, you have all the kind of body horror that you have with all these, which is to the absurd level. You have these effectively moe characters who are having issues with their head popping off because, well, whatever reason, it
head banging, and they're like, head how banging. Do their necks go back far back?
it's just too much fun, and I had a blast watching it. And then at the same time, it's technically an idol show, so you're having fun with that aspect of it. You have the girls pulling together to tackle this particular concert, or what's the problem with really creepy guys? Let's deal with that problem in this particular situation. Or what happens if your past comes back to haunt you or something like that? And let's just leave it at that, and you can figure out that if you actually watch it. So there's a lot of things that are really, really fun in this show. And it was actually a very surprise little special thing. And it easily, like Andrew said, it ended up topping one of my lists, I believe.
It's sad. Not sad. It's cool to acknowledge the fact that even when they're kind of not makeup and they're kind of at that zombie form, they still look really moe.
Yeah.
How can you modify zombies? Damn it, Mappa. I also want to kind of acknowledge the fact that every single one of the performances they do were like really well done. I absolutely loved the rap battle that Sakura and Saki had. It was kind of this, they did it so well. The actual back and forth they had was hilarious. Saki talking about how she can't have her Tamagotchi or Tamagotchi and how it's probably dead by this point. Tamagotchi?
I think it's Tamagotchi. She may have called it a Tamagotchi. Tamagotchi. She may have called it a Tamagotchi.
Yeah,
just for that.
Just to kind of, yeah. It's not quite it. No, I wouldn't doubt that they would do the actual name just so that they can drum up the interest in it, because I know that it was just coming back.
Yeah,
so
maybe came back.
Maybe they were doing it for advertising purposes and they slipped it in there because she was obsessed with it.
I actually had it on my iPad for a little while. It got really annoying. You have very to quickly. Have a
keychain.
Too much time.
It's got to be the keychain.
Too much time to focus on it.
Yeah, I don't know how I managed that back in the day. Really, I thought Lily's episode was absolutely cute and adorable.
I loved Lily's episode.
Really, really charming ending to it. I liked Aya's story and how really messed up her death was. That was one of those other things where it's like you kind of wanted to have... They hit, I think, all but maybe three of the girls' backstories and how they died. And they're all kind of really screwed up deaths. Like Truck, Cliff,
no,
Lightning.
What I really loved was the fact that they were so...
A hair.
I loved the fact that they were so self-aware of what they were doing with these girls. Was how absurd they were making the situation go on. And then they kind of tied it into the story with the I have the worst luck ever thing going on. I really loved how self-aware that they were with that. But yeah, each one of the girls were just an absolute treat to watch.
Like I said, though, the only downside is I think we didn't get enough of Yugiri. She did have a really great final scene with Kotaro that was really awesome and funny at the same time, because he's like, that's exactly what I said. But yeah, she smacked him.
And you know what's funny for me? Tai Chen absolutely grew on me to no end. I really, really enjoyed Tai Chen. She just was just too much fun.
Yeah, she was too much fun because she's literally trying to eat everybody every 2 seconds and they're having to hold her back. But yeah, it was really excellent. I really enjoyed it. It was really well put together. Great animation. Love the lightning strike auto-tuning. I don't know how that works, but they did it. A lot of fun throughout the entire thing. I think the only thing that was kind of a little cringy is they had some CGI dance routines. Some people claim they did that as a joke, but I think it was kind of like, well, if it was a joke, they wouldn't do it twice, and they did it twice. So I don't think that was necessarily a joke at the idol animes itself. Can this be considered a idol show for the when we eventually do another idol episode?
It'll destroy.
It's gonna destroy
all
everything. there's nothing that can stand against it. That's not fair.
I don't know.
It has all the elements of it.
I believe it's an idol show. That's why I said it's an idol show.
They had like three idol performances, which is more than most shows have. Most idol shows don't have three full performances. And it has all the drummings in there.
They had a unique Idols concert every episode, didn't they?
But what I'm saying is that not all of them were technically, you know, standard Idol things. It was rap battles and headbanging on a stage. It wasn't all, like, you know, traditional Idol stuff.
An auto-tune episode. They had a...
Street performance.
Yeah. They had each one of them a different one.
Yeah. Definitely, it's one of those shows that I don't know if I give enough justice talking about it. It was definitely a show of the season. Like I said, a show of the year. So you would probably know that already if you listened to our Deliberations podcast, because it was definitely prominent there. So anything else on Zombieland Saga?
Go watch it.
Yep. Definitely. I love seeing this as well, because MAPPA's been kind of struggling for me over the last year or so. And I was really afraid that they would kind of get stuck in these shows that aren't really their own, that they're kind of fumbling about with. And to have them come back with an original and knock it straight out of the park, to steal something from Chris again, was definitely surprising for me. I'm glad to see that they've got their groove on. It did technically have a hang at the end of it, which does suggest a sequel, or it could be them drumming interest in their, I think they made a manga or something like that. So they could just be, you know, saying, hey, look, we're going to continue over here. If you want to read more, read over here. I hope not. I hope they bring this back eventually and continue on. And like I said, do Yugi's story and maybe do something with Tai. Even though Tai was pretty prominent in every single episode. Get into Kotaro. They technically, in the last episode, hinted at what Kotaro's whole thing was.
Yeah.
And again, that was really, really cute, and I would love to see more of it. But
I wonder, because I think at the beginning of the show, I pointed out that they're probably going to wait until, like, the last episode before Tai Chun wakes up. But I'm starting to think that that's going to be her
spoiler
thing. I guess that.
Don't.
I'm sorry.
Joking. Yeah, that's. I like I said, I was kind of saying, well, that's probably going to be something they'll fix the last episode, just because, you know, it is her thing. And if they were to fix her early on, or quote unquote awaken her, it would kind of kill that joke, which I think was definitely worth it to have the entire series, because a lot of the keep our secret thing was relying on the fact that she was just kind of running around like crazy. And she does best performance at the game show, which was great as well. So it just falls apart. They're all panicking and trying to scramble to get her back together. Great cast, though. I absolutely loved every single one of them characters. So yeah, we should probably stop. Zombieland Saga, definitely go watch it. A show of the year, definitely worth watching. So there you go. Moving on, let's go into Golden Kamuy Season 2. This one was streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Jinno Studio. Source is a manga. Genres are action, adventure, historical, seinen. And for those that missed my first review of the Golden Kamuy, or don't know what Golden Kamuy is about, it takes place right after the events of the Russo-Japanese War in the Meiji era. And at some point, Sugimoto, during the war, runs in with a particular guy in the trenches, I believe it's his friend. And his friend basically tells him, look, if something happens to me, please go take care of my wife and her child. And Sugimoto kind of agrees to it and promises him. And then after the war, his friend dies, of course. And Sugimoto kind of is trying to figure out how he's going to kind of take care of this wife and the child. And at some point, he has a run-in with this gentleman on the side of a creek, and the guy is drunk and tells Sugimoto about this treasure that this Aino man hid. And this treasure is just huge amounts, and at some point, they wake up the next morning, and the guy is sober, and he tries to kill Sugimoto, obviously kind of solidifying the fact that this is a real story, that there is actually this treasure out somewhere. The other kind of thing that's mixed in with it is that the treasure was hidden, and the map to get to the treasure was actually tattooed on a bunch of prisoners by the person that hid it. And so this kind of follows this whole thing where different groups of people, groups of military men themselves, Sugimoto along with a Ainu girl, Asirpa, all these different kind of factions and groups are all trying to find these prisoners. either draw the maps off of their bodies or strip them from their bodies, because their entire torso is basically drawn with pieces of the map. Try to find these prisoners, get the different parts of the map, get them together so they can find out where the treasure's at, and then have its worth, so to speak. There's a particular guy that has many members of the military with him, whose name is Sudomi. He's a kind of a little bit tipsy madman who kind of suffered a explosion on his forehead, and it's kind of messed up his brain, so he's a little weird. He has a group of military men, and they're all trying to find it so they can basically gather large amounts of weapons and then create their own military force. There's a guy named Hijikata, who kind of is working with Sugimoto at some point to work together in order to find it. Everybody kind of has their own purposes for trying to find the treasure, and kind of mixed in there is just kind of the lore of the Ainu people and the different desires of each of the person for the money itself. So anyways, that's sort of the story. Going into the second season, it's kind of more of the same. You're kind of having each of these groups kind of trading members. You're seeing some of the members are backstabbing other members of different groups. Different groups are kind of forming together to join together in order to meet the goal. Some are trying to sabotage. You have like Tsurumi is working with an individual to craft fake skins. And then towards the later parts, they go to see if they can find the no-faced man who is kind of possibly the one that constructed this entire map. I almost don't want to talk about this show. I think it's known by now that most people know that I don't... All right, it's known by now that I don't really particularly enjoy the series. I was really excited about it in the first season. I thought it was going to be a fantastic show. I heard a lot of hype behind it, so I was excited to jump into it. It has a cool setting. I really enjoy the Ainu aspects of it. I enjoyed the character designs, some of them anyways. But it's one of those shows where it has a cool premise to it. It opens up really strong, but it kind of, in between the higher points of the show, I get really bored watching the show. And I think what I kind of boiled it down to is that I don't find pretty much all the humor to be funny. It just doesn't connect with me. And that's one of those things where for each person, comedy is completely different. Some people find something absolutely hilarious, and some people find that it's just not. And for me, this show, the comedy just doesn't work for me. And it is a show that heavily relies on it. It is almost kind of 50-50. I would almost say probably 25% serious and then 75% comedy. And when you have that kind of formula in the series, it's going to lose me because, like I said, the 75% of it, I don't find funny. It's kind of the characters, there's a few characters that are just kind of overly present that I really don't like. A lot of the characters that are surrounding Tsurumi, even though I kind of was growing on Tsurumi this season, he kind of turned into being the character that was more interesting this season, just because it didn't seem like for me that Sugimoto and his team were really doing much. Even though there was some kind of, you know, development happening for Usurpa, the rest of the characters I wasn't really enjoying. And so I was kind of more strained towards Tsurumi's side, and he's surrounded by probably the most... They're unsettling, but unsettling to the point where it's trying to be comical, and I'm just not going with it. Kohei is annoying. There was this other general son boy that was there that was obsessed with Tsurumi. Oh, they're all obsessed with Tsurumi, whom I'm talking about. And they're not funny for me, and that's what really bothers me about the series, is I can't enjoy it because there's all these characters that I really, really don't like, and all the comedy is not funny to me. I thought the Chitata thing was funny the first time they did it, and then they keep doing it over and over again. Oh, they're doing the Chitata thing again. They're chopping up the things again. They're saying Chitata, and they want everybody to say it. I get it. That's funny. Move on, kind of thing. So that's my struggle. I really, really enjoy the series when it's serious, and it just isn't serious enough. And sometimes when it's serious, it's just boring. So that's my struggle with it. I really want to enjoy the series. It just doesn't work for me 75% of the time, and that's the struggle. It had a really strong last arc, which I did really enjoy. It got really dark. But other than that, it was just, man, I still really enjoy Gonzalo's story. I love that he has some connection with another character this season, so I love seeing his character advance. I love his connection with Huki and the rest of the Ainu. He's probably the best character in the series. I really like Ogata as well. Really solid character. Like I said, I was starting to enjoy Tsurumi this season as well. It's just, yeah. I'm beating the dead horse at this point, so I want to enjoy it. I keep trying it. I shouldn't, because I know people will get frustrated with my negative thoughts on it, but I'm trying to enjoy it. It just doesn't work for me sometimes, so there you go. Sugimoto the Immortal and the Golden Kamuy series. I'm certain they'll probably have a third season. I'll have to see when it comes around if there's too much that season, if I want to continue on or not. I know that it's already got an OVA that's coming out, and I'm certain it'll have a third season as well. So if you're enjoying it, definitely keep enjoying it. I definitely see where the fun is in it. Just, yeah, not for everybody. So there you go. Golden Kamuy, second season. That's all that I want to tell you about it. Don't hate me. Moving forward, we have Space Battleship Tiramisu Zui.
Oh.
Or Zui? Is it Zui?
Seeing
is
as how Zui? You watch this show, I Zui? Guess you'll go ahead and talk about it.
Uchu Shinkan Tiramisu 2. This one was streamed on Crunchyroll. Remember, 13 episodes. There is a 7-minute short, so it's not very long. Probably about an hour and a half at the most. Being done by Studio Gunzo. The source is a web manga. The genres are comedy, mecha, sci-fi, slice of life, and space. And this one, for those that missed our first season review, basically follows a guy named Subaru. He is I almost wanted to say world-renowned, universally known mecha pilot. He's very skilled in his mecha. And then kind of the funny thing in the first season, they kind of point out the fact that his cockpit is his zone, his home. There was nobody else in it. It's like his shell. He wants to be very comfortable there. Often when there's battles happening, he's always kind of struggling over, like, there's a dust mite in here. It has to be perfectly clean and perfect, or somebody messed with my cockpit and prettied it up like Honda. And, that's kind of the deal in the first season. They kind of open it up with that and explain that whole thing. And then going into the second season, we get more into his brother and what his brother's kind of doing to master the art of the, what do they call them, like the space awakened individual. It's kind of like their new types of this particular stories, because it very much so plays off of jokes about Gundam, especially the second season. The second season was just going all out with the jokes about Gundam. So it essentially is a comedy that is circled around, or is based around the idea of making fun of mecha shows and sci-fi shows and space shows. And that's kind of the deal throughout the series. So, yeah, that's Space Battleship Tiramisu Zui.
Yeah, they literally were doing the recreated, like...
They played a joke off of Char and Lala.
They
had a little scene like
Subaru
that.
Subaru Beyond is not a new type. The ones where they clone them.
Yeah, Cyber New Type.
Cyber New Type. So they were doing that.
They made jokes about plug suits and how you have to get inside these. Well, that was kind of more in this first season, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in the first season.
The Escalade Cadillac, he's a guy that essentially is voiced by the guy that does the voice for Char Aznable. That was the thing that I picked off right off the bat. I was like, oh my gosh, that is totally Char's voice. What the hell are they doing? And he totally has marital problems and stuff. They play jokes off the new type thing a lot in this season. They had the whole joke about how Izutsu wants to be a new type person. I know I'm calling it new type, I just don't remember the name of it. But he wants to be a new type, but yet, like, this co-op guy comes in.
Universal Sense or something like that.
It's Universal something. The guy from the co-op comes over to make a delivery, and literally he activates the mecha, which frustrates Izutsu. That kind of stuff. So they definitely have a lot of fun with it. They make jokes off the idea of combining mechas and how the guy becomes like part of the gun's barrel, so that when they fire off a shot, it's like super hot in there, and how it's terribly designed so it heats up the main cockpit as well. Just really funny things like that. So if you're big into mechas, if you're big into sci-fi shows, it's definitely a must watch. Especially if you're into Gundam, you're going to get a lot of the references and probably find a lot of that stuff really hilarious, like I did. So,
and if you're like us and you don't actually go for that kind of humor, you can always say that you never watched it and just go ahead and watch it. And then when you go to put in your top 10 list, just leave a spot there and just, it's never filled.
He pays for his stuff with a Velcro wallet. I had way too much fun with it. It was a show that, it's very rare that I have a show that I'm laughing literally almost the entire show. And this show just did that in spades. Every episode, I just could not stop laughing. It just got those. Often whenever I laugh, it's kind of more like a chuckle or just a quick smirk or whatever. This show was really one of those ones where it just yanks those laughs right out of the gut of my stomach, which was just rare, and I really, really enjoyed it. So
yeah, there's a lot of goofy humor in this. It's quite a amusing show to watch.
Yep, that's Space Battleship Tiramisu's Way. Definitely go check it out. Again, if you're a sci-fi fan, you're gonna probably find a lot of enjoyment out of it. Moving on, we have Goblin Slayer. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, and thankfully, at the very end of the last episode, they had the adventure will continue, so they're definitely hinting at doing more, which is great, which kind of implies that they're going based off the light novel, because I think the light novel goes further on, which, unless they do the side stories, I guess. I thought they were going based off the manga because it was doing all the stories that the manga had which the manga has stories not in it that were in the light novel that I've noticed. So I figured they were going based off the manga. So yeah, the studio is White Fox. The source listed here is the light novel. The genres are action and fantasy. And this story takes place in a fantasy setting. Kind of plays off the idea that there's these gods that roll the dice for, you know, the beings of this world or whatever. It follows a guy that they name Goblin Slayer. The shtick that they have for this particular story is that nobody has real names. Everybody's kind of named after whatever class or race they are. The particular person that's the main character is like the only one that has more of a unique name, which is Goblin Slayer. Which he got the name Goblin Slayer from people because that's all he does. Every time he goes into the quest giver has all these quests that they can do, slay the demons, Lord King, do this or do that, that, you know, gets them more money and rank. He only goes in there and says, I want jobs for killing goblins. And you kind of get a backstory for him. You obviously see that he has some trauma in his past about goblins. But he makes it his point to slay goblins because nobody wants to do them. They're just so low rank. But he does acknowledge the fact that the goblins are probably one of the most dangerous things for the general population, because when the goblins come in, they come in masses, they attack farms or villages and kill all the people within it, take all the females, drag them off into their cave, impregnate them so they can make more goblins that will then spread, and they just breed and multiply. So they're kind of the biggest threat to the general population, whereas, you know, the standard demon and everything is way off in the distance. They're in these main locations, and people go over there and fight them. But everybody ignores the goblins that are technically the biggest threat to the, like I said, the general population. Anyways, starting the series out, you follow the priestess, who's this girl that joins this really starting out group of adventurers. They just want to jump in their cave and take on their first adventure, and they're very ill-equipped and very inexperienced, so they face a lot of tragedy. But the Goblin Slayer shows up, saves the priestess and one of the other people, slays all the goblins, and then you kind of get this perspective from the priestess about how brutal the Goblin Slayer is, how tactful he is, how smart he is, and how to kill these things, and how he doesn't really give them any kind of leeway. He even kills the children goblins, because he knows that they're going to grow up and do the same thing that the parent goblins did. So, yeah. Shortly after that, you kind of have where the priestess wants to join the Goblin Slayer and work at his side. And then later on, he's kind of joined with the elf archer, the dwarf shaman, and the lizard shaman, who want to employ his help with taking out some goblins that are in a particular location. So yeah, that's kind of the gist of the story. kind of sideways to that, you kind of meet the guild girl that gives him the quest and acknowledges his hard efforts. The girl at the farm that kind of he stays at and his connection with her, and just some run-of-the-mill adventures that he meets along the way. So, yeah, this one is one that I was really looking forward to because I did read the manga. I was really into it. My main draw to the Goblin Slayer series was just kind of the tactical aspects behind it. Yeah, it does definitely either push you away or draw you in on its first story, which is basically where you watch the priestess go into this cave with these other adventurers and how they get brutally murdered and raped and everything like that. And that's kind of almost like the introduction. It's like, you're either going to be okay with this or not. And I completely acknowledge that people are not going to be okay with that. What I kind of told most people was that, at least for as far as I read in the manga, that was probably the most brutal scene that you ever see. I've been told the light novel has worser scenes in it, and I have flipped through them, and I don't really see them as bad as that. But I guess to each their own, what they're going to see as more brutal and whatnot. One particular scene in the light novel talks about how they gut these women and then feed them their intestines to kill them. That kind of stuff is this. It is a very dark fantasy, and it doesn't really hold any of the violence or what it's depicting back. So keep that in mind going into it. It is a brutal series that doesn't really hide the darker sides of this fantasy world. Some people can say that that is trying hard. I don't really see that. I see it as more of this is just the brutal reality of this world, and the writer doesn't really want to sugarcoat anything, which I really enjoy. It was kind of the same feeling that I had with Grimgar, whereas Grimgar kind of hit different themes. I don't know if it hits these other themes later on, but I kind of like that aspect. I like not being, and I'm not saying it negative to those that are offended by it or are swayed by it. I don't like being babied. So this is when I want to have a dark fantasy story, I want to have it and not have anything held back. Anyways, like I said, the thing that ended up kind of drawing me to the Goblin Slayer series was really just the tacticalness of the Goblin Slayer. Just kind of seeing how he tactfully takes out a situation, because what it starts out is he's kind of a loner. He does everything up by himself. He doesn't want to get involved with anybody. You almost get a sense that maybe anybody around him would probably just be a hindrance to them. He's very tactful what he does. He has a short blade because he's going to be in a cave, so he doesn't want it to hit the wall. He sets up traps. He knows the signs that are placed there. He knows that there's a shaman there because there's this totem pole there at some point. All these kind of things that he kind of tactfully observes and then counters, which is really cool. And then shortly after, you kind of realize later, as he's kind of getting the priestess, he gets the other members to join him. He kind of uses them almost as a tool. Not that he sees them as tools, he utilizes them as tools. So now he's got an archer with him. So obviously he's going to utilize the archer to shoot from a distance to shoot this one eye or to shoot this thing down. He has a shaman with him, so he's going to make the shaman, collapse the roof. So everything is a tool for him in killing goblins. If the goblins aren't involved, he doesn't do it, which was something I kind of appreciated. He's focusing on the slimes of the RPG, which nobody cares about the slimes once you get past level 3 or whatever, but that's his only focus. Most people in this particular world don't care about the goblins because they don't see it as a threat, and they're only focused on gaining rank and gaining money, whereas him, he just likes simple living as long as he can just kill these things that he obviously doesn't like. And I really appreciate that. That was something I really enjoy. So yeah, that is definitely the thing that drew me to it. I think it was an awesome adaptation. I think the only thing that I didn't really appreciate was, and I guess it goes in that whole realm of manga versus adaptation kind of thing, I didn't like they put the farm battle at the very end of the series. At some point, they jumped to the Sword Maiden story, and I was like, wait, are they skipping the farm battle? What the hell? This is like where the Goblin Slayer literally has to force himself to accept help. And they're doing this later? That doesn't make any sense story-wise, because he's now then going to Sword Maiden and accepting help from you know, his new members of his party. It was a pinnacle part of his story. It turned out okay because I did like that it does give a really good climax to the series as a whole. Whereas if they did it the other way, the climax would literally be him. I guess that would technically be a pretty strong climax at the end of that one as well. The Sword Maiden and the farm battle definitely have their own climaxes, but I think it was really cool to kind of have that gathering together of the adventurers at the very end of the series. And I was surprised to see how well they did the farm battle, because I was really afraid, because they said they did an episode delay for like a week, and I was like, crap, that means they're struggling with how much they're gonna have to animate. I hope they don't use like a bunch of CGI. And they pulled it off really well. The animated is a lot better than I thought they would. Yeah, it's a really cool series. If you're looking for a really dark fantasy, it doesn't hold anything back. Be advised of that. There is a lot of brutal murders. There's a, like I said, rape, depiction of rape, stuff like that's all in there. The trauma of these things as well is all kind of mixed in there as well. The aftermath and how that affects the people that are a part of that, so to speak. It's really cool in how it's tactfully presents each of the fights. Each of the fights has some kind of strategy built into it. It's not just let's rush in there and swing swords. A lot of it kind of boils down to here's this tool set. How does the Goblin Slayer use it to defeat the enemy? So, and I would definitely look forward to more of it. So definitely a cool little series. And I'm kind of invested at this point. Like I said, it would be cool if they did a second season and they jump into the side stories they had that they did the manga out of, which was his backstory, which gets into full detail. They did hit a little bit on it in this series with him and how he was trained, but not to the extent that they did with the side story manga slash light novel. So yeah, that's Goblin Slayer. I really did enjoy how they adapted the mage too, because that's one of those things in the manga. She just has like a very drawn out way of speaking, and I think the Seiyu pulled off her voice really well. I actually really enjoyed her a lot more in the anime series than I did the manga. So yep, that's Goblin Slayer. Check it out if, like I said, you're looking for that. All right, next one we have is Fist of the Blue Sky Regenesis 2, or Shuten no Ken Regenesis 2. This one's streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by studio Polygon Pictures. The source is a manga. The genres are action, historical, martial arts. And this one follows Kenshiro, who is like the 62nd successor of the Big Dipper style, or Hokuto Shinken. He is part of a group of individuals who kind of lead a gang, and they're always against this other gang. In the second season, after saving Erica, they rush off to Indonesia. It's like 4 years later after the first season. And there they're trying to kind of hide away. They have this kind of little orphanage where they're taking care of kids. But eventually they are found by the Nahash people. And the Nahash people come there because they see that Erica is the prophesied Migadol. And that the Migadol will give them these, what they call them, the lightning rods of power that they need in order to rise to power. And so Kenshiro and his, what's left of their band of people from the first season, are protecting Erica and keep them from these Nahash people. And eventually she gets captured and they get into who the Nahash are and who this Himuka guy is, and the history of Kenshiro and his long lost brother and all that kind of stuff. But yes, it's just an excuse for them to rip off their shirts and fight each other. I know. I would say that this season was a lot better storytelling wise than the first season. I did appreciate the first season for how they kind of told Louis Faye's story, and I really did enjoy I think it was Guigan Pan. They kind of had a cool little redemption story for the first season, which I really did enjoy. But this season was kind of more focused on finally telling what Erica's story was, because in the first season, everybody wanted her for this kind of index that she had in her brain, or that she had memorized, so to speak. This one kind of tells exactly what that is and gets into why they want that power, which was really cool as well. But yeah, I think it is just one of those shows where I do have a lot of fun at certain points, but it is another one of those ones where it is just an excuse to watch these guys kind of beat the crap out of each other the entire time.
Okay. This kind of begs the question, because I remember right, you told me what the thing is that she knows. And my curiosity is, if you've got guys who can blow people up literally by tapping them with their finger, what's the point if in what she has as far as knowledge?
Well, what's the funny thing is because one of the people after this particular knowledge, they tell his backstory and why he kind of went crazy and wanted to fight war, which was kind of tragic and how they kind of portrayed it. He literally gets so angry, he basically takes out an entire army of people. So yeah, it does kind of beg the question of like, well, what's the point in having this knowledge when you just, when you were a kid, in your backstory, you took out an entire army. Stop, Chris. It's not the point. It's the lightning rods of Migadol. You have to get them. Yeah, it is technically absurd. They have like, okay, this character technically was punctured in a way that he's going to die, and well, just I'm going to puncture this and that's going to extend my life. And they have a lot of puncture points. They even have a puncture point that they can hit that causes somebody to follow their command. It's just, it's absurd stuff like that. The way that they punch, and they can punch through somebody's stomach or their chest, and make snakes appear out their backs and punch with literally thousands of fists. It's absurd action like that. Where'd your t-shirt come from? You just ripped it earlier. How does suddenly you have a t-shirt on again? Why does Kenshiro smoke like every 2 seconds?
And yet he's the finest specimen of a man
of
ever.
Health and strength and maybe he's got a tumor in his neck because their necks are so huge. Who knows? I think overall with the Fist of the Blue Sky for me is it's one of those things where it is another one of those ones where the humor I don't really follow. It kind of constantly has this duo of guys that constantly shows up and they make them into the comedy routine and don't really care much for their comedy. So the comedy is always a miss for me. I think the thing that I always end up kind of enjoying about the series is they do pretty solid redemption stories. And you have these characters who they feel like they need revenge for something. They need revenge for somebody's death, or they feel that somebody's wronged them, and they feel that they have to follow in somebody's footsteps, and they always somehow turn that around. Yeah, a lot of it is really kind of changing somebody's heart by the connecting of fists, kind of cheesy aspect, but they're always cool little kind of redemption stories that I always enjoy, and Kenshiro's little puños and how they always kind of their bonds are stronger than anything else has always been an enjoyment of the series. So yeah, it's a mixed bag for me. It is one of those shows where I can't really say that it is the greatest thing ever. It is nowhere near it. It's kind of a meh series.
Do they get their redemption just before they die or what?
Some of them do.
Because like they're always talking about how everything is going to kill them within one hit.
No, that's only the lackeys and stuff.
Oh, those
are the ones that they poke in the side of the head and they say, "You're already dead," and then blood flies out of their bodies everywhere. Yeah, I mainly went after it because it's Polygon Pictures and I always enjoy their series with like Ajin and stuff like that and Isidonia. This is definitely not of their pedigree, unfortunately, but it was an interesting take from them. So yeah, it's Fist of the Blue Sky. Had a decently conclusive ending to it, so I'm not sure if they'll have more of it, but we'll see. Yeah, Fist of the Blue Sky, Regenesis. I probably did the worst review of that if you're a big fan of Fist of the Blue Sky and Fist of the North Star, but I'm not a huge fan of the series as a whole, so I'm certain I'm probably missing some kind of symbolisms or something in there that everybody's yelling about. So.
Mm-hmm. There's tons of symbolisms in there.
Oh, yeah. It
has something to do with his neck.
The Megadol lightning rod thingamajiggy.
No, it's his neck. His neck is always the symbolism.
Oh, the way the veins kind of come together?
Yeah.
Or what do you call those things? Anyways, let's conclude with Thunderbolt Fantasy, The Sword of Life and Death.
This isn't anime, Andrew.
Yeah. Thunderbolt Fantasy, The Sword of Life and Death, and Thunderbolt Fantasy Season 2. I kind of said in our first impressions that we'd go ahead and cover the movie and the second season together. That way we'd actually cover it, because I didn't really want to do a separate podcast for the movie. But yeah, I don't remember exactly when The Sword of Life and Death released. I think it was sometime early last year, which right now it's 2019. But we never did get a chance to watch it. I don't, because it kind of somehow crept into Crunchyroll's lineup and totally missed it. But yeah, the for those who don't know what the Thunderbolt Fantasy series is, it is, yes, it is puppetry. It is, was it Chinese puppetry? Essentially, Nitro Plus, I think Good Smile Company, and a Taiwanese puppet company, Peely International Multimedia, so it's Taiwanese. They kind of got together along with Jinro Bucci. They also had Sawano Hiroyuki come in for music as well for it. It's kind of this meeting of minds. And I think it's one of those ones where we probably wouldn't even give it a second glance because it is puppetry. And we do kind of technically try to stick to anime in specific. But due to the fact that it is Jinro Bucci, that caught our interest. And then Andrew seen Sawano Hiroyuki, and in his usual Sawano Hiroyuki fanboyism, he decided to start drooling, and he wanted to listen to it at least. So we kind of jumped on it and checked it out. And we were really surprised by the craftsmanship and the quality of the CGI and the performances and everything they were kind of putting into it, that we decided to stick with it. And we really enjoyed the first season. So it was a given that when they went to the movie in second season, we'd kind of jump onto it. So yes, your pre-warning, we are talking about a puppet show. So there you go. But keep listening, because I think you'll be surprised. Anyways, the movie itself, I guess the story kind of follows a guy named Shengbu Huan. And this is going to be my first critique when I eventually get into it. I hate the names, by the way. They're very Chinese names. Anyways, I think they call him the Bladeless Swordsman or something like that. Wasn't he the Bladeless Swordsman? Edgeless Swordsman, something like that. So we're going to kind of call him their nicknames. So yeah, we'll stick with those kind of things. And the Bard. I don't remember if they gave the Bard a name, so I'm going to call him the Bard. Anyways, if all this edgeless blade guy, wandering blade guy, he kind of travels into this new type of land. He actually traveled over this area, which was known as the Wasteland of Spirits, which nobody has ever been able to cross. But on the opposite sides of this Wasteland of Spirits are these two locations, one being Dongli and one being Ziyu. He traveled from Ziyu to Dongli. And in Dongli, he is kind of traveling around, and in the first season, we kind of follow this guy who is trying to, basically, he collects swords, and he's part of this really nasty cult that just goes around and mercilessly kills these groups in order to steal all these weapons. And in this particular, the first season, we followed, it says a Vermilion Kingfisher, I think was her, I don't remember her name was. She was a shrine maiden who was trying to hide the hilt of this blade, because the bad guy got the blade part of it, and it was a really powerful blade, and she didn't want him to have it. And the edgeless blade guy, wandering blademan guy, is helping her kind of hide it. But at the very end of the first season, we kind of got like this reveal that this wandering swordsman had this index of swords, this sorceress sword index that had 35 magical blades within it, that he can summon any one of these blades and use them. And it's kind of one of those kind of, whoa, wait, you had this kind of moments? Like, where did this come from? So we kind of are going to find that out in the second season. In the middle of these two seasons, we had the movie. And the movie was, again, something we're going to review here, which is the Sword of Life and Death. In this story, during the first season, we met the Screaming Phoenix Killer, which was this really nasty guy that would, like, he was an assassin, and he was, like, terrifyingly skillful. Like, he was just tearing up people. And so we never knew why this killer hated this thief so much. He literally, the entire first season was him just wanting to kill him. He just hated his guts. Well, the movie finally told us why he hates his guts so much. It was a really cool movie. I was really surprised. It was longer than I expected it to be. But basically, the very first part of it basically covers how the thief and the killer met, and how the killer tells the thief his backstory, like where he was born, how he had eventually met his master, and how his master taught him the blade, and how his master no longer likes him. And then they go off to, I believe, which was the sword art assembly, where this master was basically having all these fighters come to this arena and fight and see who was the who could actually claim the title of the sword saint. And so the thief and the killer go there, and they kind of talk a lot while all these battles are happening. And then the ignatic blade, Phoenix killer would go out there and do his competition and so on and so forth. But it was basically to tell his backstory and just basically give you an idea. And it was really screwed up. I have no doubts whatsoever anymore why he hated him so much. So it was cool to get his backstory, get more of the Phoenix killer, and get more insight to how clever this thief guy is and how he loves to manipulate people so much.
That's one thing that I do come away from it. Now that I've seen the entire second season, I realize how much value there actually is in that movie, because the movie, in revealing the Phoenix killer's backstory, it also very much shows a lot more information about who the enigmatic Gale is and how, what it is that his goals are, which
what makes him tick.
Yeah, what makes him tick.
He loves manipulating people, and that was a shining example of it, which, yeah, definitely gives you a lot of perspective of his character going in the second season. I mean, you technically got a lot of it in the first season, but it just kind of solidified it for you. So yeah, it was a really cool movie for that. I loved getting more in depth to these characters. It essentially gave me more character development for the two most fascinating characters of the series as a whole. So what's not to like about it? It was pairing up these two characters that I absolutely loved in the first season, gave more depth to them in this movie. Which again, foreshadows a lot of things going into the second season as well. So it was really well put together, really cool little fight scenes. And it had a little funny moment in there as well with showing the Wandering Swordsman running into somebody who was trying to act as if he was the Wandering Swordsman, which was really funny as well. So it had a little funny moment in there as well for
nice
comedy.
Nice
little recap.
Yeah, recap.
Yeah, well done recap kind of thing. So yeah, going into Thunderbolt Fantasy 2, this one basically jumps back to where the first season left off and jumps right into where the Wandering Swordsman is trying to find a location to hide this sword index. So now we reveal that it exists. He is now trying to find some place where he can stash it away so that it can be protected, because he doesn't feel that he wants to keep it on himself and possibly lose it or have it stolen or whatever. So he's going to a temple where he can possibly see if they will take it and give it protection. Well, come to find out, suddenly everybody starts crossing that wasteland of spirits that we were told in the first season was so dangerous and nobody could possibly live crossing that wasteland. Well, we find out that during his travels through the wasteland, he pretty much took care of all the threats of the wasteland. So everybody's starting to cross it. One such being Zi Ying Luo, which is this kind of, she kind of is, what do they call her, the Princess of Cruelty or something like that? The Witch of Cruelty? I think it was the Princess of Cruelty or something like that. The Princess of Cruelty, she basically masters in poisons and likes to poison her targets, has a lot of scorpions that she can command. She comes in and grabs this particular scroll. They fight over it. She managed to grab half of the scroll or part of the scroll and runs off with it. And so we're kind of following as the Wandering Swordsman is trying to get this scroll back. He's joined with his friend from way back there as well, who is this bard who carries around a really obnoxiously annoying little instrument that likes to talk too much.
Chatty Cathy little guitar.
Chatty guitar. The Gale, at the same time, elsewhere, starts to work alongside the magistrate from the government on the other side of the wasteland as well, who is trying to track down the wandering swordsman who obviously stole this scroll and wants to take it back. And I think the only other main character we run into is this wandering monk that shows up and seems to have no purpose but to try to find purpose in people and helps people as they're, in trouble or poisoned or whatnot. And yeah, that's basically the opening of Thunderbolt Fantasy. Just kind of everybody is kind of three-parter. You have one side of it is them trying to track down the scroll parts. One side of it is kind of getting into the scroll itself and the powers that it has. And this other side of it is kind of getting into the Dongli side of the lands and the magistrate coming over and the Gale working with him, so to speak. And pretty much none of the characters from the previous season, they had one kind of, every now and then they would have like an episode where one of the characters would pop up, but it was mainly just like the Wandering Swordsman and the Gale were like the only ones that were really a substantial part of the season. So yeah. What do you think of Thunderbolt Fantasy 2?
I really did. Overall, I enjoyed it. And let me put it that way. It takes a while to get to an ultimate standoff point, and then you start understanding why everything is happening. And I think that's something that you really, if you go into this and you go, well, what's really the point? I think that is the point. It takes too long to get to the point, and then once you start seeing it, it really has an awesome payoff. You just got to get to that point. It feels like it takes a long time to start putting all the pieces into play, because it's playing a lot off of, like Andrew was mentioning, getting the index into the hands of this big fortress. And then after a little while, for whatever reason, we have to remove the scroll from the fortress. And then you have a interplay between a couple of characters, and then you have new tools that have to be played, and those tools and what they're doing and explaining all that. There's a lot of explaining in the first 7 episodes. And then the last 5 episodes were really, really phenomenal and very much make all those first 7 episodes worth it.
It's weird for me because it both shows the strong ability that is in Jin Ibuchi, and at the same time, it's one of those kind of weaknesses as well, is I really wasn't sure if I was going to like this season at all, because, yeah, while the battles were still fun as hell, like, that was the thing with the first season, it was, the battles were fun as hell. The first part of it is, like, everything outside of the battles is like, what are we even doing here? And it always seems like, eventually, he kind of just goes, oh, yeah, this is why this is all kind of, this is what I was building up to. He's always kind of, he skillfully crafts these characters and how the pieces of the chessboard is kind of moving till eventually it gets to that point where you go, and then it all kind of clashes together. He's a very skilled writer. Everything, when you get to the end of it, is for a purpose. He does a lot of foreshadowing that you don't really see until the later parts of it. How he brought in this monk character, which I thought was probably the most interesting part of the first part, but he wasn't doing anything with him. He literally just like, he was coming in and speaking riddles and popping poisons out of people and talking about worth and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, what is the point of this guy? He's fascinating, but he's not really anything crucial to the story. And then eventually it kind of, like I said, it gets that later part and everything comes together and you're like, oh, this is why he was foreshadowing all this stuff. I appreciate that in his writing, but I also have to put out there that for a good part of this story, I was really bored. Like, not really bored, but like just, because all the action, like I said, the action scenes are always still fun. And they love to throw these action scenes in there to kind of wake you up, I guess, so to speak. But there was scenes like with the Gale and the magistrate in the earlier parts where they're gabbing on, and I'm like, yeah, I don't really get anything here. So it's one of those really struggling things for me, because a lot of the early segments of the second season, I was following it, but at the same time, I wasn't really engaged except for the fight scenes. But I have to acknowledge that his writing is so good, because by the halfway point, it just all fits together and he just pulls something really fantastic out in the end. I thought that it's by far his last episode of this season was probably the best fight scene I have ever seen in any medium in a long time. They took every little thing they've been kind of hinting at, all these mechanics they've been utilizing throughout the entire season, and threw them into one battle. And I was like, holy, at the end, I was like, holy crap, that was an awesome fight. I was literally hyped the entire time.
And that's kind of what I was hinting at the fact of each one of these things, even mechanics that are, like Andrew was saying, mechanics that are placed all the way back towards the beginning of the show, and you're like, that has got to be throwaway. No, there is no use in this information. They use that information. They use that information. That thing right there, it's important.
Yeah, and I think the only reason I really struggle with because I know that when we did the first season review, I was struggling with the dialogue as well there. A lot of the conversations it just felt like he was overly complicating a conversation and making it too drawn out. But at the same time, it's not that there's any useless dialogue in there. I think the only reason I really struggle with the conversations is I hate the names. And I know it's probably a bad thing to say, because they're technically, you know, Chinese names or whatever, Taiwanese names. But the problem that I have is that they don't really pronounce it the same in the Japanese recording of the dialogue than the actual names themselves. And it's hard to really connect who they're talking about sometimes unless they reference what they often do this. They'll say like Lin Yue Ya's name, the Gale. They'll say his name, but they'll quickly throw a quick jab in there about how he's a, you know, he's a conniving person or he's a thief or whatever. They always throw some kind of reference to their character in there somehow so you can kind of, oh, that's who they're talking about. But sometimes they don't. So a lot of the references about names, locations, it's really hard to follow sometimes, but at the same time, it all kind of fits together in the later parts. So it's kind of a mixed bag for me. So to kind of break it down, the visual, I don't know, we actually never really talked about it. The visual craftsmanship that they have in this series is still absolutely fantastic. The CGI works really well with the puppets. The action scenes are always fun. Every fight scene, it's skillfully crafted. It's just the choreography they put into it. No fight is as simple as slash, slash, slash. There's always some kind of absurd thing they throw into it, like a character will somehow eject their sword out of the hilt, or they'll eject the hilt at somebody, or the way they cut things apart, the mechanics of the weapons they're using. Everything is really cleverly crafted and just has so much fun and design to it. The puppets themselves are beautiful. The designs of them are fantastic. Even when the fact that you have these really close-up shots of them, I think the only thing that's kind of weird is that they have these really big, gigantic lower lips, and half the time they don't move, but sometimes they do move when they're talking. But they're beautiful. They're beautiful puppets. They move so lifelike. They're just beautifully animated. And then you cut in the great music, the great camera angles, the different shots that they have, these puppets. The amount of effort they put into the series is just phenomenal. I absolutely love the presentation value of this series from beginning to end.
One of the things that when we talk about how the puppets are moving, there is an exaggerated motion to it. Yeah. But there isn't.
It's almost like stage shows Where stage shows, you can't see their facial expressions, so, in which is exactly here. They don't really have much facial expression. So they do a lot of motion with their body. Their arms are flinging out, or they turn a lot, and they accentuates their emotion a lot.
Well, one of the really interesting things that I wanted to add to that is one of the coolest things that you'll see in this, and in there it was shown in the first season, so you could actually probably just watch the first episode and see what we're talking about as far as how well this stuff is done. But one of the things that kind of caught my eye in this particular season was with the Princess of Cruelty that Andrew was mentioning earlier. She was in a fight and she was overwhelmed at some point. And how they one of the things that they do tend to do a lot in these shows is they do tend to show feet and how they move in a lot of cases. And one of the times that she got overwhelmed, they backed up and showed her feet kind of losing her footing as she was backing up. And it was really well done. And it's things like that that make just the little extra touches that they do when she's being overwhelmed by a certain particular character that's revealed later. She's so overwhelmed, you see sweat. Or the Wandering Swordsman, who's been poisoned at some point, hit the sweat on his face as he's overwhelmed. And another character that through chi gets poisoned, knocked out of his system, and blood spurts out of his mouth, and the leftover goes down its face. It's the little touches like that that they do that stuff just to make that point of they're trying to make these as lifelike as possible, and it's really well done.
Yep. Now I've forgotten where I was going with that, but yeah, I did want to hit on the fact that the presentation value is phenomenal, and it is completely multiplied by, like I said, the choreography and how they pulled off, especially that last fight, which I thought was, like I said, probably one of the most fantastic fight scenes I've seen in a long time. But yeah, outside of that, I think the storytelling is fantastic. It is just excellently crafted. Besides my issues with how a lot of the dialogue is and the other parts of it, it all comes together, and it's the way that he designs this world and designs the mechanics and pulls it all together, and how he basically told several really fantastic stories, one being the Gale and what he was doing with the Magistrate, how that kind of came together towards the later part was absolutely fantastic. Having the Wonder Swordsman going after the Blades, and how him and the Gale worked together in the very end. All that stuff was great. And like I said, the monk, I think, was probably one of the more shining beacons of the season. I didn't even see it. I knew they were going to do something with him, but I didn't think they were going to go do as much with him as they did. And I thought his story was probably one of the most entertaining parts of this entire season. And a particular blade that we meet later on was fantastic as well. It was just a fantastic series, even though, like I said, I had my issues with the earlier parts of it. So I definitely suggest it, just as much as I suggest the first season. It's just a really fascinatingly crafted, so much effort put into it. I give them huge props for what they did with this stuff. I know that if you watch the movie at the very end of it, it shows kind of some backstage stuff to kind of give an idea of the efforts they put into this and how they craft it, which is phenomenal. So yeah, that's Thunderbolt Fantasy, The Sword of Life and Death, and Thunderbolt Fantasy, the second season. Definitely check it out if you're okay with puppets. And Suwano Hiroyuki.
It's funny.
And Jinrobuchi.
They're actually surprising the size of these puppets. It's really surprising when you see the backstage things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all we have for this episode. We hope you guys enjoyed this review. Of this, do we have any spoiler discussions in here?
Not that I know of.
Okay. All right. I think the only one I would want to talk about is probably Thunderbolt Fantasy, but we've talked plenty outside of the podcast about it, so it would just be us rehashing and acting like we're talking about something we haven't talked about before. That's always a struggle sometimes. Like, I have to sometimes stop ourselves from talking about certain things. It's like, yeah, but we want to talk about it on the podcast, and I don't want to sound like we're already talking about something we already talked about.
And then when it comes around, it's already been completely not worth talking about anymore.
Yep. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I hope you guys didn't mind Chris's zombie voice.
Yeah, I'm not sick, guys. I really am not. I just, my voice is shot for whatever
reason.
Why
would anybody care if you're sick or not?
I don't know.
Well, you would think somebody's going to go like, oh, I hope you're okay.
Yeah, that's probably.
Is that all it is?
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to get a whole bunch of, are you okay?
No. Like they're going to suddenly go, I'm oh crap, sick. I got to turn this off. I might get sick. just to kind of give people a quick snippet, our last part where we have, the shows that we have left is Uzumaid, Release the Spice, Ulysses, John's Arc, Anima Yell, Hero Mask. I'm trying to finish Boarding School Juliet, and I don't know if I'll go back and finish Rebited.
I'm going to probably knock out Juliet, for sure.
Yeah. So at least we'll have Juliet. I'm not sure if I'll watch Rebited yet.
I was going to ask if there was anything you wanted me to watch, which I've already watched Anima. Is John Dark? It didn't look interesting to me at all.
No, don't. No. Yeah. No, don't watch John Dark. If you have troubles with Goblin Slayer, don't watch John the Ark.
Well, I do plan on going back to Goblin Slayer at some point. That was one that I really didn't want to let that go.
Oops. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know if I'll watch. If all else failed, we'll just have, you know, those six or so shows to watch or to catch up on. So either way, that's something you can look forward to. We hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Again, we're at talkingspear.com. You can go over MNU and all great community forum and stop social media on the right side and all that good stuff. And you all take care.
Oh.